Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's about 17 seconds after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for an exciting chapter of Juneau Afternoon. We have a really great lineup of guests today. Boston Christopher and Shona Strausser will be here to start things off to tell us about the performance of Betrayal that's coming up at Perseverance Theater. This is the first time anyone's done a Harold Pinter play in Juneau, we think. Tim Olson will drop in to tell us about the upcoming legislative coverage on 360 North. We'll have Doug Murray from the Murray and Associates, the folks who designed the heating system at the airport, for our sustainability segment today, talking about how to get off of the fossil fuel program a little bit. And Barbara Thurston and Kristen Bartlett and possibly some others will be in to talk about the school budget process. All that will be coming up on Juneau Afternoon. Stay with us. The next thing you'll hear will be National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Opening arguments were heard Monday at a trial that centers on South Dakota's social services issues. As Jim Kent reports, an attorney and children's advocate are accused of disclosing confidential information and witness tampering.
The origins of the case date back to 2011, when two Lakota girls accused their white foster parents of sexual abuse. Attorney Brendan Talafaro and children's advocate Shirley Schwab assisted the girls in bringing their foster father to justice. The man is now serving one sentence for rape of a child. Regardless of the man's guilt, Talafaro and Schwab are now being prosecuted for the manner in which they assisted the Lakota girls. Daniel Sheehan is the lead counsel for the Lakota People's Law Project and is observing the trial.
The prosecutor laid out his case, asserting that they assumed that this must have been a setup by getting these kids to testify, because it was too coincidental that all of the information that was necessary to bring criminal charges against these people ended up being said by the girls.
Sheehan says he sees the case as a situation of retaliating against whistleblowers. The South Dakota Department of Social Services refused to comment on the trial. Prosecuting attorney Michael Moore did not return a call requesting comment. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
An Oklahoma tribe says it's surprised the U.S. Supreme Court is taking on an adoption case. KGOU's Kirk Wortney reports.
The U.S. Supreme Court says it will review a state court ruling that forced a South Carolina non-Native American couple to return their adopted daughter to their child's biological father, a member of the Cherokee Nation living in Oklahoma. The High Court agreed late last week to hear the appeal by Matt and Melanie Capabianco. In 2009, the couple adopted baby Veronica from her mother in Oklahoma. The father, who was not married to the child's mother, claimed he should have custody under the Indian Child Welfare Act and was allowed to take her back to Oklahoma in December of 2011. The law gives the child's tribe and family the right to have a say in decisions affecting the child. A statement from the Cherokee Nation says the South Carolina Supreme Court's decision to give the father custody was correct and should stand. Cherokee Nation Attorney General Todd Hembree says the Cherokee Nation stands ready to defend the rights of Native American children to be raised in Native American homes. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Oklahoma City.
Idle No More protests are showing no signs of slowing down. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
What's most unusual about the Idle No More movement is that it's become a simultaneous national uprising, reaching across the country through rallies, protest marches, and even rail and road blockades. They've even threatened to close Canada's borders with the U.S. The protesters and their non-Native supporters want to end Aboriginal poverty and protect treaty rights on First Nations land. The spark was Bill C-45, omnibus legislation that included changes to the Fisheries Act and the Navigable Waters Protection Act. Native leaders say the legislation strips First Nations of their treaty rights. And protesters such as Negan Waywidum Sinclair say it's about the government wanting to get First Nations people out of the way so that they can develop Native land without interruption.
This is all about the pipeline leading to the West and resource exploitation throughout areas like the oil sands, which goes directly through First Nations territory. That's what Bill C-45 is all about.
The protesters say the legislation threatens their treaty rights as set out in the Constitution. And many predict the demonstrations will continue and gain momentum, despite an announcement recently from the Prime Minister that he will meet on Friday with Native leaders. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
During this week in 1923, Ira Hayes was born. He became famous for helping raise the U.S. flag during World War II. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. This is a court-ordered legal notice for Native Americans. The Cobell Indian Trust Settlement is approved. If you believe you might be included in the settlement, you need to file a claim by March 1, 2013 to get a payment. Information is available at the website indiantrust.com or by calling 1-800-961-6109. That's indiantrust.com or 1-800-961-6109. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes and 6 seconds after 3 o'clock. Tune to KTOO News. My guests in the studio here are the folks who were about to bring Juno the first Harold Pinter play that the Juno Perseverance Theater has ever done. Boston Christopher and Shona, who's Shona is the star of this thing, playing Emma. I don't have you turned on here.
Oh,
there you
well,
go.
I said, now, oh, sheesh.
Yeah, Shona Strausser. Anyway, she plays Emma, and a great role it is, too. So we were talking just beforehand about the way this play is constructed. It's at the time, it was kind of revolutionary.
Yeah, absolutely. It starts with basically the premise of the play. It's called Betrayal, and it's the main plot of the story is that Shona plays Emma, who is married to Robert, but she's having an affair with Jerry, her husband's, who happens to be her husband's best friend. And we learn all that in the very first scene. And from there, the story mostly unfolds backwards. There's a few scenes that then go in order again, so you can see some of the ramifications of things that we learn. But it's sort of about all the various kinds of betrayal, self-betrayal, the smaller kinds of betrayal beyond just the fact that she's having an affair with someone else. In terms of the lies that are told, the truth that is underneath those lies, and we work all the way backwards through the various stages of this affair. And when people find out certain things and how long they keep that information and. It's a very interesting construction. And when it first premiered in London, 30-something years ago, most of the critics didn't quite get it because Harold Pinter had been writing a certain other kind of style before that. Sort of, they called him absurdist, which he really wasn't, but The Birthday Party and different plays like that. And so this was sort of a departure for him. It's a very personal story. It's actually based on an affair that he actually had. Not the one that everybody thinks, but there was a woman named Joan Bakewell who, in the 60s, he had an affair while he was married to Vivian Merchant. Everyone thinks it's about his second wife, Antonia Fraser, but it actually isn't. And there's some great detail about that if people are interested in looking it up. It's a fascinating story. And so then when he wrote the play, he started with the image of two people sitting at a pub talking about the past. And when he realized what they were talking, that's how he usually starts his plays. He says he starts with an image or a couple of lines. And then when he realized what they were talking about, he said, well, I better go back there and explore what it is that they're talking about. And so the only way to do that was to go backwards. And so that's how the play was constructed. And it's considered his most accessible and also probably his most personal play.
Great line by Ray Bradbury about writing says that what he starts with is a couple of characters talking to each other. Same thing here. And then one of them will turn around and look at him and say, that's something I could do.
Right, right.
He's got the story.
Yeah, yeah. And he's known for his economical use of language, and it's very fascinating story.
So, Shona, what do you think about this role? Is this new ground for you? Or?
Well, you know, I have to say it kind of just – how I am as a person, I'm usually a character actress, you know, so meaning that I usually do funnier roles, like funnier, faster, bigger is kind of our big, you know, it's like our big joke. But character roles tend to be just a little bit louder. And Emma's definitely the romantic lead, and that's not something that I'm used to doing. So it's something that really pushes me every day.
Yeah. When you say it pushes you, can you elaborate on that? What do you have to do?
Well,
what goes on with the push?
So we, when I think about the roles that I usually do, I do lots of musical theater and I do funny roles, you know, where your face has got to be, you know, you have to be more engaged facially. Your face has got to be bigger. Your body's got to
refresh everybody on the stuff that you've been doing.
I have actually been off the stage for a couple years. I did Boom last, which was a comedy, you know, and that was very much it was a big comedy. So that character was really bold, out there, really kooky, you know, a little crazy, weird, and funny, you know. And this one is, you know, she's very much a real person, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Whereas sometimes you can get a character and people have ideas, like they're like stock characters, you know, like, oh, I know that person, that is the comedy, the comedic foil. Like, that person is there to make the show funny in certain spots, which I'm usually that person. And so this is like the complete opposite, so.
You have to, like, put Emma on.
What do you mean?
Like a costume. Do you have to go through kind of a, is there a process?
Oh, there's a process.
Well, she, if people know Shona, she's actually straightened her hair, which is a big deal. And but, you know, I think it's actually...
There's some photographs that make that into a really big deal. You've got some pictures of you on the web with a lot of hair.
Oh, I have a lot of hair. Yeah. It's huge. Yeah. Didn't you know it's just, like, bigger than anywhere else in the world, actually? Yeah.
But I think it actually, what it does, I think, for Shona, I mean, when you talk about it, I don't think it's putting it on, but it's sort of allowing her to access parts of herself that maybe are a little bit more vulnerable, that are a little bit more romantic, and allow herself to sort of find the stillness of it, you know, and yeah.
She had to get some help from you, I bet, on this, because when you were in Of Mice and Men, one of the things I noticed when I was watching you was that even during the bows at the end, you were still in character.
Oh, really?
All the way off stage, you walked off in character.
As Robert Downey Jr. says, I don't get out of character until the DVD commentary is over.
But you really, I could tell that you had that guy in your head. I mean, you were...
That was the hardest acting role I've ever done, for a variety of reasons. But I think this process for Betrayal was... about sort of finding, because Harold Pinter's also known for his use of silence and pause, and he's very specific about that. And so the way we explored things was to find the stillness and the silence, and just to kind of start from that place and really look at the text and really use that as a Bible. And these guys are word for word, comma for comma, you know, ellipses for ellipses, and it's very important in the way that he structures the play. There's a very funny interview that he did with Mel Gussow about what did he change in this play during the original production, and he says, I cut a pause, I added a pause, and I removed a comma. And Mel said, did that make the difference? And he said, that made all the damn difference.
Yeah.
And so for him, it's very much about the musicality of the language and what it says, and so that's what we did a lot in exploring these characters and finding sort of those intentions behind that text.
Yeah. At a point when you were talking about the silences, you nodded your head. Is there?
Well, it's interesting because I love music, and so I read music, and I love it, and so. For me, it's actually looking at the script.
Hey, you were Diva of the Year in 2011.
Oh, shit. It's a different kind of diva
in
the show.
She never lived that down either.
No, it's everywhere. It's ridiculous. In the middle of Jack. Stop being a... whatever. But that it's a musical script. Like, you know, how you see rests in music. That's exactly how I look at this script. Those pauses or rests, the silence are key changes. Like, it's... very musical for me, and the way, and when we're in the rhythm of the scene, it feels, you can totally tell that it's like the band is on or the band is off. So it's very rhythmic for me, and I really enjoyed that part because it's something I can really kind of pin into.
Okay, I gotta see this, so when can I?
We have a preview tomorrow night, our Pay What You Can preview at 7:30 p.m. tomorrow, that's Wednesday, and then we officially open on Friday, this Friday, January 11th. We run through February 3rd, Thursday through Sundays at 7:30, with the final matinee at 2 p.m. on February 3rd. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's when you can see it. And you can go to perseverancetheater.org or call us at 463-TIXS.
And if I miss it here...
Oh, if you miss it here, or even if you love it here, please tell your folks in Anchorage. This is another one of our moving to Anchorage shows, and we'll have actually a couple months before we do that. So we won't be playing up in Anchorage until April 12th is when we open up there.
Outstanding. Yeah. And you've got a different guy playing the waiter, an Anchorage actor?
Yes, we have James Sullivan doing it here, and in Anchorage it's David Haynes. And then the other actors involved in the show, we have Aaron Wiseman, who's down playing Shona's husband in the play from Anchorage. And then... a really young, wonderful actor named Daniel Billett from Los Angeles is playing Jerry.
Yeah, they're great. Both of them are great. It's been a really fun process.
Betrayal. It opens...
This Friday.
This Friday. Gotta
right.
go.
Gotta See go. Me a little number, too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. All right. Hey, little tenor music, kind of. Maybe appropriate thought here.
Thank you.
Life has a tempo we never have time for. Feels like we're all missing out. No time for the beauty that always surrounds me. Walking my head hanging down. I wouldn't have believed it, cause I never used to see it. You give this life meaning around me when you make the world. Turning in circles, when will my feet touch the ground? Lost in a race, no one's a winner, finally turn me around. I wouldn't have believed it, cause I never used to see it. You give this life meaning around me when you make the
World Stand Still. The four tenors are Frazier, Victor, Remigio, and Clifton. And I have looked all over this album for their last names, and I can't find them anywhere on the album cover. So maybe they just want to be known as the four tenors. Beautiful harmonies those guys have got together. It's an album called The Tenors, Lead With Your Heart. And quite a nice little piece of music we just received down here. My next two guests are going to tell us a little bit about programming on the television station that's associated with us. So Tim Olson and Jeremy Shea are here. Hi, guys.
Well, and I wish we had more exciting names after that. But, as your
you
next
can,
guest,
you can change your name.
We might have to do that. Next time we'll come back with different names.
Well,
that sound
once
much
you
more...
see how my last name is spelled, and I see some excitement.
Well, thanks for having us, Pat. You know, the reason we try to come on and tell people what's going on, because, of course, we have three public television stations in Juneau that come out of KTOO-TV here. And the one that originates here, the statewide service that 360 North runs, Gavel, Alaska, is one of its most popular and long-time programming streams. Jeremy is the producer of Gavel, Alaska. And next week, when the legislature convenes, our programming changes a little bit for 90 days to accommodate gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Alaska State Legislature. That starts on Tuesday at 8 o'clock. And we have some changes and some exciting things going on to help people access government better. And Jeremy's been working on those a great deal for this year with a whole team of people trying to make that government coverage better every year, and this year they've got some great things going.
Yeah, and the big thing we've been trying to push with Gavel to Gavel is like more accessibility to the Capitol and more digestibility. A lot of the proceedings that happen in the Capitol can be kind of arcane and hard to understand. So this year, of course, we're not changing anything with TV. It'll still be, you know, Gavel to Gavel coverage on 360 North. But we're trying to do a lot more with the web as well, and to help bridge that gap and make it a little bit more digestible. We've got a Twitter account, at Gavel Alaska. You can follow us there. We'll be live tweeting some high-interest meetings at Gavel Alaska. And we'll also be kind of putting out short little newsy nuggets that fit within 140 characters on Twitter. So that's been helpful. We did some of that last year, and we're going to continue doing that this year. We've got our Facebook page, just Gavel Alaska. You know, you can just plug that in. You can find our Facebook page. We're posting a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes things on there. I might post some short videos that explain some of the jargon and things like that on there. And we've got some photos up right now of the crew training, if you want to take a look at that. Kind of cool. If you've never been over here, you can see some of that. And then we've got a new website, too. That's going to be launching soon. We don't have a definite date yet, but soon we'll have the new Gavel website. That'll replace the one right now at gavelalaska.org. It'll redirect eventually to 360 North, where both the sites are going to be kind of folded together for about 3 months before it goes back to...
Gavel Alaska started in 1994, 1995 as an experiment, you know, and it's been going for, 18 years now. And this 360 North Television Service of Alaska programming grew out of the Gavel to Gavel Alaska, and we've worked at integrating that Alaska material and information for people. And this year we'll see more and better things on the web, and the 360 North and Gavel Alaska websites are combining, and they'll be combined from now on with the Gavel Alaska and Alaska government information taking the top billing at the top of the fold for the next 90 days, because that's really what we're focusing on. Jeremy mentioned we just posted some crew pictures. You know, we really ramp up this time of year with adding a large number of staff people. We have two or three crews in the Capitol doing live television, and we have control room shifts here working in the building to provide the statewide service. And our programming on 360 North really changes, and that's one of the things that we like to point out to people. 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning, we're going to start covering the legislature during the day. We usually have 2 hours of news and weather in the evening from 6 to 8. Well, the legislature usually goes past 5 o'clock, so we changed that to start at 7 p.m. with the BBC World News and the live Alaska weather. And we usually have a little bit of Alaska programming, some of our special programming at night with, you know, Native American programming, Alaska Indigenous People programming, specials about Alaska. Then at 10 o'clock, we go back into Gavel, Alaska, and run repeats of the things that happened during the day. There are more meetings. Jeremy and the team cover more meetings than can possibly even be broadcast at one time. So there's a lot of time shifting going on. Right. It's a ton of information there, and we move the schedule around, and we'll really be accommodating the Gavel, Alaska programming for the next 90 days.
So a time slot that somebody's used to seeing a program in could actually change even on that week if something big is going on at the legislature.
Well, actually, you know, from 8 to 7, we are at the Capitol with live coverage.
Okay.
So that's going on. Often there are multiple meetings going on at once. We have more than one crew carrying that. The meeting that starts first, or one that appears to have a lot of activity going on, will be going live. We'll simultaneously have the other one. We'll broadcast that on the television channel immediately afterwards. We, you know, put the stuff together in a way that we can get as much programming on as we can. Jeremy works with the schedule very carefully. And then also on the website, of course, you can go back and listen to and watch all of the meetings at gavelalaska.org and 360north.org. So we're trying to make everything as accessible as possible and cover as much material as possible. And every year for the last many years since Jeremy has been producing Gavel Alaska, we've increased the amount of coverage that we do. And this year they're just adding more and more ways that you can access that from your mobile device, from your website, you know, from the web, social networking. There's just a lot of different ways to try to let people get information about the government. That's one of our big focuses in public TV here in Juneau.
One of the great things about the website, too, is, you know, we tend to follow the oil taxes pretty closely because that drives, you know, so much of our economy and so much of our state budget. But maybe you're sick of following oil taxes, but that's what's on TV. You can go to the website, and if we're covering other meetings at the same time as, you know, your umpteenth Senate Finance or House Finance Committee meeting on oil taxes, you can follow that other bill that we might have coverage of in another committee meeting simultaneously live on the web, which is great. You know, so yep. Maybe you're interested in the dog bill or whatever it is.
We got three channels, and yep. I don't want to take the thunder away from the legislative coverage, but what happens to the other two during this period?
Well, so our three public television channels in Juneau, we have Alaska Public TV. That's the traditional public television fare, the programs that you've loved maybe since you started watching Sesame Street a long time ago and those shows. We get that through a partnership with our sister station in Anchorage. It provides the Alaska Public Television signal. Then we have the Create Channel, which is a public television service that we just added on July 1st that has a lot of programming of how-to programs, travel, needlework, woodworking. Those were very popular programs, but there was never enough room for all of them on the traditional public television stations. And then, of course, 360 North originates right here in Juneau and is the statewide public affairs in Alaska channel. The other two channels will maintain their same programming. Wow. 360 North, we massage the schedule quite a bit because we're doing we'll be doing between 600 and 800 hours probably of live television over the next 90 to 100 days, and we really open up the schedule on 360 North. This is one of our main missions to do this. It's something that KTOO has done for almost 2 decades, and this is that 90 days where we really concentrate on this coverage of Alaska government and information that many people around the state use the service to get.
Which was the point I was going to make. This isn't just limited to Juneau broadcast. I mean, people watch this thing in barrel.
Yeah. 360 yeah. North is the most widely distributed television channel in Alaska. Yeah. We have through almost every cable company in the state, including GCI Cable. We have transmitters in Bethel, Anchorage, Juneau, and on the rail belt from Talkeetna all the way down to Homer. I mean, we cover the entire South Central area. Gavel, Alaska is on the air on a transmitter in Fairbanks. So we have transmitters in all the major communities. We have almost every cable company in the state. We're on DirecTV, Dish Network. We just added a cable company in the Aleutians, so the people in ADAC will be watching Gavel, Alaska live off of television rather than the internet, and will be able to watch both the internet-covered meetings, the ones that we cover at gavelalaska.org, and watch it on television at the same time. It's this network that we've been building since 2007 and now is the most widely distributed television channel in Alaska, and it brings you Alaska government.
We're just almost out of time, but maybe one of the two of you knows the answer to this. How does our coverage of our legislative process
pointing at me.
Compare to other states?
Oh, gosh.
Well, I know a little bit about this because there is a group of state networks that cover public affairs. There are several states that do television coverage in a manner like we do here. 30-some states do public television or non-commercial type television coverage and internet coverage of their legislatures. Most of them do. Some of them do as extensively as we do. When I came here several years ago, one of the reasons I came is because this place was one of the leaders throughout the country, and our general manager is very active in the national organization of public affairs networks. So people come here and ask us how we do it sometimes, and it's been something that's been developed over years, somewhat through trial and error. It's started as an experiment and has turned into something that a lot of people count on and we take real seriously.
Yeah. A valuable resource for the whole state of Alaska and particularly for Juneau. Thank you so much for telling us about it, Tim. Jeremy,
sure.
Thanks for dropping
Thank
by.
You. Thanks for having us come in.
Coming up, Almanac, and then a Writer's Almanac, and then after that we'll have Doug Murray here from Murray & Associates. He's going to talk to us about the Juneau Airport heating system.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 8th of January, 2013. It's Elvis Presley's birthday today, Tupelo, Mississippi, 1935. He didn't intend to become a singing star. He was a truck driver for the Crown Electric Company in Memphis. He just wanted to make a record for his mother for her birthday. And so he scraped together $4 to go into the Sun recording studio and record My Happiness, and That's When Your Heartaches Begin. The recording engineer liked the voice. He turned over the recordings to the producer, Sam Phillips, who called Elvis back into the studio. Elvis sang a few more slow ballads. Sam Phillips was not too impressed. And then in between takes, Elvis and the other musicians started fooling around with an old blues tune called That's All Right, Mama. Sam Phillips asked them to come into the studio and record it. They did. and the next day it was played on the radio in Memphis. Elvis was so embarrassed he hid out in a local movie theater. But the record That's All Right, Mama sold 6,000 copies right off the bat, and it was the beginning of his career. He went on to record 149 songs that made the top 100 on the Billboard pop chart. It's the birthday of Emily Green Balch, the writer and pacifist, born in Jamaica Plain, New York, 1867. She was a painter, she was a poet, and along with her friend Jane Addams, she co-founded the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, for which she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1946. It's the 71st birthday of physicist Stephen Hawking, born in Oxford, England, 1942. Went to Oxford, never attended lectures. He was bored with most of his classes. They seemed too easy. It was only after an oral exam that his professors realized how intelligent he was. He was studying for his PhD when he was diagnosed with ALS. His doctors expected him to live only 2 to 3 more years. He was depressed at first, but then his condition seemed to stabilize, and he got engaged to one of his classmates, and he set out to finish his PhD and discovered that he liked the coursework, focused his studies on black holes, and in 1988, Stephen Hawking decided to sum up all the research on physics and astronomy in a book for non-scientists called A Brief History of Time from the Big Bang to Black Holes. It came out in 1988, went on to sell almost 10 million copies. His latest book, The Grand Design, came out in 2010. Stephen Hawking, asked in a recent interview what he thinks about most in a day, said, "Women. They are a complete mystery." Here's a poem for today by Adam Posner, entitled Myth Dispelled. "The flu vaccine cannot give you the flu," I tell him. "It's dead virus. There's nothing alive about it. It can't make you sick. That's a myth. But if we bury it in the grassy knoll of your shoulder, an inch under the stratum corneum as sanctioned by your signature, in a white-coated ceremony presided over by my medical assistant, and then mark the grave with a temporary non-stick headstone. The trivalent spirit of that vaccine has a 70% to 90% chance of warding off the evil one, and that's the God's honest truth." Myth Dispelled, a poem by Adam Posner, M.D., used by permission of the poet here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, helping make professionals and businesses look their best in search results and online review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Nick Vedder. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 27 minutes before 4 o'clock. So the music says that we're going to talk a little bit about this project that we've had ongoing on Tuesdays on Juno Afternoon, the idea of sustainability for Juno. My guest today is a fellow who has engineered some sustainability into our airport. Doug Murray is here from Murray & Associates, and Doug is the guy who did the design job on the heating system for the airport. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Doug and I are personal friends. We actually study karate together a couple of nights a week, so he much better than I. But anyway, Doug, that heating system out there is a fascinating thing. How's it work?
Well, it's a geothermal ground source heating system that where we transport antifreeze fluid from wells in the ground to a number of heat pumps that are above the ceilings in the airport. And those heat pumps above the ceiling essentially extract heat out of the fluid, or in some cases put it back into the fluid, and then distribute that through a forced air system in the airport.
So this is a two-way thing. In other words, you can cool a building or you can heat a building with the same system.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Now, does it use, is there an external energy source running the heat pumps? Do they?
Yeah, that's essentially the electricity from AEL&P.
Okay, so they're hooked up to the electric power, and their purpose is to move this refrigerant fluid through the system.
Yes, the electricity essentially energizes the refrigeration circuit, or otherwise called the vapor compression cycle, and that essentially moves the heat from the antifreeze fluid into the heat pump, where the heat pump then can move that heat to another medium, and in this case, to the air.
Why do you have to drill down?
Well, you need to get surface area on your heat exchange. In this case, it's the tubing. And so at the airport, we have 108 wells that are each 350 feet deep, and there's a double tube in each of them, and it comes out to about 16 miles of HDPE piping that is then manifolded all together and slowly moves down through the ground and picks up heat from the ground and then moves it into the building where it can be used.
So it's hotter at 350 feet than it is at the surface?
Not necessarily. What we're looking for is a real steady temperature that we can then extract heat out of. So in reality, the heat down there is really only about 43 to 44 degrees. And so we're extracting anywhere from 3 to 6 degrees out of that. So we send it back to the loop field at, say, 38, 39 degrees.
So the idea is that you extract 3 or 4 degrees, but you extract it over and over and over again so that the temperature inside the building builds up.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's the beauty of the heat pump. The heat pump is understandably kind of a mystery. Whenever anybody asks, you know, how a heat pump works, they usually get kind of a patent answer of, well, it's a device that moves heat from one medium to another. I think a little bit simpler, you know, way to understand what a heat pump does is that all of us, you know, have a heat pump in our house, and that's the refrigerator. And so thus, you know, when you close the door to the refrigerator and something is warm inside, the refrigerator itself goes through its vapor compression cycle, extracts the heat out of that warmer object to the walls of the refrigerator, which then moves to, you know, through the refrigeration process to the coils in the back of the refrigerator. And that's why you can put your hand in the back of the refrigerator, and it's oftentimes, you know, pretty warm.
And those coils are the analog to all of this pipe that's buried under the ground.
That's
it takes
correct.
that much surface area. It gives you that much more surface area to be able to to dissipate the heat from the hot object inside the refrigerator.
That's right.
Yeah.
One of the beauties about the airport system, I can just get into this because I'm pretty excited about this, and that we discovered that through the months of May through October that we weren't really using heat out of the loop field at all. There was so much heat being generated in certain areas of the building, like the TSA screening areas, that we were pulling heat out of that, putting it into the antifreeze solution, moving it off to the next zone that then extracted the heat out. So we're essentially just recirculating through the building, and the only real cost is electricity to run the heat pumps.
So unfortunately, I don't have the kind of money it would take to build that system into my house. What is the possibility of using something like this to heat a home?
That's a great question, and it's one I get a lot. Heat pumps have a limitation, and this is the biggie, is that they can heat heating water up to roughly 120 degrees. So if you have a house that's already heated with radiant floor heating or with forced air heating, you can take advantage pretty readily of the heat pump process. If you have a house that's heated like a lot of us with, say, baseboard heating, which is heated off of a boiler, chances are it's going to be tough to retrofit your house for geothermal heating unless you do a wholesale, you know, retrofit. And that's because the baseboard heaters need, you know, 160 to 180 degree temperature water in order to give off heat, something that so far is not obtainable with heat pumps.
So if I were constructing a new house and I decided that I wanted to try this, what kind of field would I have to, how many wells would I have to drill, or would I have to drill wells?
Yeah, roughly for geothermal, it's looking like maybe 2 or 3 wells for a decent-sized house. If you do a horizontal loop field, which there are several now in Juneau for residential, it's looking more like a 200 to 250 square foot area that has horizontal pipes with a real good cover, 7 to 8 foot of cover on it.
So you dig a hole 7 or 8 feet deep and big enough to carry, to have all that area
right.
in it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you put the piping system down in there and fill it back up, and that's what you begin to generate the difference in temperature with.
That's right, yeah. And that process is usually one that a lot of homeowners like to think they can do, but then when they see the cost of it, either drilling the vertical or doing the horizontal, then they balk at it.
Yeah. Digging big holes in your backyard is
exactly. But what we're finding is that the payback is pretty incredible. For instance, at the airport, the additional cost we figured out there was about $1 million. Half of that was a grant that the city and borough received from the state. Our initial life cycle cost analysis showed that we would pay that off in about 10, 11 years. Well, from the numbers that we've received last year, we're getting a savings of about $125,000 a year. And so that actually represents a payback of somewhere around 8 years now.
If you do that payback calculation just on the heating of the building, it doesn't come out perhaps as attractively. But in the process of this, you also built in a system that de-ices the ground outside the terminal itself.
That's correct. We have 7,000 square feet of sidewalk and raised ramp that I know everybody that's used the airport has seen in the winter, because it's clear and there's nobody out there shoveling or chemicals.
Yeah.
And that 7,000 square feet is melted from the ground, yeah, using 3 water-to-water heat pumps.
And they would not have – I think the reasoning that I read about on your website is that they would not have been able to do that as economically as you were able to do it as a result of the process.
Absolutely. Either electric boiler or oil-fired boiler, that probably would not have been an option for the owner. That's correct.
So for a far north airport like ours, it's really a wonderful cost savings process and like that. I'm intrigued. If you don't have – I want to go back into this business of you need – radiant floor heating or something like that in the house if you were going to do this. Can you explain exactly, and you said that my registers in my house have to have 160 degree water. What's the temperature range that a heat pump system will normally generate?
Yeah, on the heating side, anywhere from say 90 to 120 degrees is what the heat pumps will then kick out for heating purposes. Down south, where the ground temperature is a little warmer, they can push that 120 degrees a bit longer in the year, and they can actually use what's called a de-superheater to heat up your domestic hot water also.
Huh.
It's tried a little bit up here, but really at the middle of winter, heating domestic water, they should have a separate system for that that can pick up the slack and then just use the heat pump for the heating system. Otherwise, you size your heat pump too large.
Which is, I remember when I interviewed Alec Mestag, he was talking about the idea that you could use a home furnace system to bring the temperature of the house up to about 62 or 63 degrees. And then, or maybe I've got it backwards, maybe the idea was that the heat pumping system would hold the temperature in the house to 60 or 62 or 3 degrees, and then you would add the additional 8 degrees with a non-renewable energy source, and that would cut your heat bills way down because you'd basically be getting heat from both places. I hope I've got his thought correctly stated there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so an existing system might be used in that fashion, but you'd still have this engineering problem of having to dig a big hole in your backyard.
That's correct. For residential, they're fairly new on the market, although it's maybe older technology too, but it's been modernized as what's called an air source heat pump. And the same kind of thing is that it can be retrofitted pretty easily into radiant floor heating and to forced air heating. So it's a little bit cheaper than, say a geothermal source. The air source has to deal with the winter environment, but the modern pieces of equipment nowadays look pretty promising.
Wow.
Here's the real attractiveness, of heat pumps. And what we found with geothermal anyway is that we're looking at about of a a COP, or a coefficient of performance, of 3, which means for every $1 a kilowatt that you of electricity that you use to run the heat pumps, you get 3 kilowatts of heat out of it.
Huh.
And you compare that to a boiler, it's for every $1 of oil that you spend on a boiler, you might get 80 cents of energy out of it.
Huh.
So that's... It's kind of a comparison of efficiencies.
It's much, really, much more efficient for the investment.
Yeah.
Well, all we got to do now is solve the retrofit problem, and we'll be rich men, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, little appropriate music to close this thing out. We got one here called Steam Powered Airplane. Thank you very much, Doug, for coming down and talking with us.
And I damn near didn't come back again. I didn't go very fast on a steam-powered airplane. Oh, the wheel went around and up and down and inside and then back again. Sitting in 747 just watching them clouds roll by. Can't tell if it's sunshine or if it's rain. Hey, hey. I'd rather be sitting in a deck chair high up over Kansas City on a genuine old-fashioned authentic steam-powered aerial plane.
Steam-powered airplane. We actually have not a steam-powered airport heating system, but Doug Murray was here just a few minutes ago telling us about the wonderful technology with which we heat the Juneau Airport now from wells in the ground running through heat pumps in the ceiling. An amazing system. We have another amazing system that we're about to put into effect here, and that is the amazing process of getting to a school budget. Joining me here are a couple of folks who have a key role in this. Barbara Thurston and Kristen Bartlett are here. Hi.
Howdy. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
So you're going to have 17 people, I think, who are going to meet for a period of about 2 weeks or longer to generate the school budget. Why so many and why so much? Why so long?
It's actually more than 2 weeks. It's 2 months, actually, from the middle of January through about the middle of March.
This is Barbara speaking.
Yes. The budget committee is actually going to be a bit larger than it has been in the last few years. We did an evaluation after last year's budget committee to see what worked and what didn't work. And one of the frustrations we found is it felt like there was not a sufficient amount of resolution. The committee didn't have the authority to sort of finalize any recommendations. So that's one of the changes we made this year, is that the budget committee will actually create a proposed budget, which will be submitted to the board for full consideration. The committee is as large as it is because we really wanted to have representation from around the district. Budget committee consists of people who were recommended by each of the schools around the district. That's about a dozen people right there. Each school recommended somebody. We have representatives from some of the bargaining units, the teachers, and then the other classified staff. And Then we have a couple of at-large members who may not actually have children in the district, but who are members of the community and felt like they'd have an appropriate role for that. So it's kind of a large committee, but it's a nice variety of people with a nice variety of backgrounds, and they're all prepared, or say they're prepared, we'll see if they know what they're in for, to really look at these numbers and make some recommendations.
The overall size of the budget is around $76 million, I think. Isn't that...
The overall budget is about $90 million, but the operating budget, which is the budget that we have the most flexibility in determining how it's spent and the board has oversight of, is about $77 million.
Kristen, what's your role in this process?
Well, I am in a support role in this process, providing information to the budget committee members. One of the nice things about this committee is that it is an advisory committee to the board, but as we go through this detailed process, there are 7 meetings that the committee has agreed to attend. Each board member is also a part of the process, so they're listening and hearing all of the conversation. They're getting all of the same information, so in the end, when they receive a recommendation, they really understand what went into making that recommendation. So as a part of the process, you might imagine there's lots of information that needs to be shared. So David Means, our Administrative Services Director, is our key budget person at the Juneau School District, and I help him in putting together just all of the information that the committee members request and that the board needs to make this recommendation. And at the third meeting of the budget committee, the superintendent will actually present a recommendation for the committee to consider. So I'm also involved in the process of putting that together. And even as we speak, he's meeting with all of the school principals to get their input into creating a budget for the next fiscal year.
And Barbara, what's your role?
I am a school board member, and I'm actually chairing the budget committee. I'll be jointly chairing it with one of the community members who has not yet been identified. But a lot of my role is to help the process move along. As Kristen mentioned, the board members will be involved in the budget committee, even though we're not voting members. And the reason for that is there is so much discussion of priorities. There's a lot of public input. If the board member sat out of that process and then only looked at the budget when it is presented to us in March, there wouldn't be enough time to really absorb it. We really need to be in on those discussions. So I'm sure that board members will contribute things to the discussions during the budget committee, but we don't actually have a vote.
The 17 members of the committee will meet. Are there opportunities for public input as well?
There are. The most valuable opportunity for public input is we have a couple of email addresses set up, and we could talk about those in a minute. Written testimony is really helpful because the committee members can look at it, think about it, you know, make notes, ask questions, whatever. But we also have opportunity at 2 of the budget committee meetings. It's the one on January 22nd and the one on February 19th, where people can come and testify in person to what they think is important or concerns they have.
And if someone is thinking of coming to one of those 2 public meetings, will they be? Is there some place where they can access what has happened in the committee meetings prior to their appearance?
Yes, as we get into this process, tonight there's a school board meeting, and the members of the budget committee will be approved officially. Once that occurs, then we'll be posting all of this information on the Juneau School District website at juneauschools.org. And you can look at information that was used during the last budget process, as well as information that's being provided to the committee members this year. And as circumstances change or as revenue forecasts change, we'll be updating that information. There'll also be some questions and answers that are frequently asked about the Juneau School District budget. And I might just expand on what Barbara was talking about, public testimony, is that it will really be in 2 phases this year. The first phase is before the administration provides their budget recommendation to the committee. So the public has an opportunity to provide suggestions ahead of the superintendent's budget being delivered. So if they want to have some input into what the administration is talking about right now, this is the time to do it. And that email address that Barbara mentioned is budgetsuggestions@junoschools.org. So in addition to the January 22nd meeting, written testimony can be given at that email.
Now, as of right now, you can actually go on your website and get a copy of the 2012 budget and the proposed 2013 budget as it stands at this point.
Actually, when you can go on the website and you can see 2012 and 2013 budget, but be aware that 2013 budget is the current year that we're in the middle of. But yes, there are several years' worth of budget information on the website, including most of the documents that were handed out to the budget committee over the last couple of years. So that's a really useful source of background information if people want to see how things have changed. And then as we're actually going to be working on the 2014 budget. And as documents are prepared and handed out to the budget committee, they will also be posted on that website so the public can keep up to date on that.
What are the key assumptions on revenues going in? Do we know or do we have some sense of what is going to be coming our way, what you have to start with?
We do. We have estimated that we'll be looking at a revenue shortfall of about $1.2 million this year. Fortunately, it's not as high as what we have faced in the last couple of years, but it is another consecutive cut that we'll be looking at. That is due to an estimated lower enrollment for next year, as well as some increased costs. We also last year received some one-time funding from the state of Alaska, which was very beneficial in the ultimate creation of the budget, and we're fortunate that the governor has included that funding level in the current his current budget proposal as well. So
you said we're looking at a shortfall again. The management model for education in Juneau, I think, has been a continual series of shortfalls for a long period of time. The question is, I guess that's the job of the committee, is to decide where the cuts have to come. Is that?
That is.
And that's what makes the committee challenging. We've been cutting as long as I've been on the board. I'd be delighted to have a year where we could decide how to expand as opposed to decide how to cut. The board had a work session a couple of weeks ago to talk about some of our priorities. And one of the things we debated is, do we want to tell the committee that there's things we aren't willing to touch? And we actually decided not to, that the committee has free rein to make a recommendation. We certainly have some priorities. Focusing on instruction is definitely one of our priorities. We recently adopted an equity plan. We want to make sure that we're in accordance with that. But there's more than one way to achieve some of these goals, and we're hoping to get some proposals.
Well, we just have a moment here. Once again, the opportunities for public input to the process are the email address, which is
budgetsuggestions@junoschools.org.
Okay, good. And the other part of this is the public testimony process, which is two opportunities,
and the first is January 22nd at the budget committee meeting, which is at 6 o'clock at Santa Kahini Middle School.
Well, Barbara Thurston, Kristen Bartlett, thank you so much for alerting us to the necessity to get involved in the budgeting process and the opportunity for people to take part in that process as well.
Okay, thanks for having us.
You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we also broadcast on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. We're on K276 AF at 103.1 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek. We're on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. KRNN, our sister station, is on digital channel 872, and KXLL is found on 873. And we're also online at www.ktoo.org. Update on the weather forecast. It's going to get cold. Tonight, we're looking at scattered showers with lows 31 to 35, and then Wednesday, the temperature is supposed to drop throughout the day to lows of 15 to 23 with northeast winds at 10 miles per hour. And then Thursday, a chance of snow with the highs around 20. 9, and again, Thursday night, it'll warm up a little bit, 23 to 31, so if you have a cold water pipe like mine that you have to periodically think about, it's going to get down to 15 degrees here in a couple of days, so that's something to keep an eye on. Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, we'll have Julie Walker from AWARE here. Andy Klein will be hosting. Brian Holst will come in with an update on the upcoming Juno Economic Development Council activities and the weekly update on Eagle Crest. Pat Moore been your host for the last hour on Juno Afternoon. Wonderful lineup of guests today. We heard a little bit from Boston Christopher about the opening of Betrayal on the 18th, or on this Friday, this coming weekend. 360 North update, Tim Olson changes in the broadcast schedule, and Doug Murray came in and told us about the airport heating system. Thanks for listening.